From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A new justice and a new term for a court in transition. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Justice Sonia Sotomayor adds a new face to the U.S. Supreme Court, but it's not clear she'll make much of a difference on major decisions. Conservatives still dominate 5-4, with Anthony Kennedy the bouncing ball on constitutional questions and precedents. If Chief Justice Roberts goes ideological, decisions on gun rights, religion, campaign spending, and executive power could be legal blockbusters. Is he more likely to guide the court to incremental rulings, less likely to be overridden, while Congress is controlled by the Democrats? On Reporter's Notebook later on, swine flu vaccine, first the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. Justice Sonia Sotomayor began her first term on the U.S. Supreme Court today. Will the conservative majority come out swinging this year, or sit back to avoid confrontations with Congress? On Reporter's Notebook, at massive taxpayer expense, the federal government is prepared to vaccinate every American against swine flu. But surveys show half of Americans may just say no, even for their children. First, this news update. As the full Senate finally prepares, the House, too, to debate health care reform, President Obama filled the White House Rose Garden today with 150 doctors from all around the country, complete with white coats that the president called spiffy.
You are the people who know this system best. You are the experts. Nobody has more credibility with the American people on this issue than you do. And so if you're willing to speak out strongly on behalf of the things you care about and what you see each and every day as you're serving patients all across the country, I'm confident we are going to get health reform passed this year. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
David Lightman is national correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers. And David, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It seems kind of late in the day to be mobilizing the doctors around the country. Isn't the debate now on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, but it really isn't late in the day. In fact, it may be just in time. I think the real crunch is about to be upon us. The Senate Finance Committee is the last of the five committees writing health care legislation, and they should finalize that process any day now, and then it's on its way to the House and Senate floors.
So they're going to be looking then at their constituents, not just at the special interests that are lining the halls of Congress.
Ideally, yeah. We would hope so. This is the time for the constituents to start speaking, because you're going to have, I would say, weeks of floor debate in the Senate, beginning maybe as soon as next week, and it's going to go on, and I think you're going to see almost every issue relating to health care that you can imagine be debated, one amendment at a time.
The doctors now are fanning out, according to the president, or at least those doctors supportive of his plan. I take it there's also now some new advertising appearing on television and elsewhere in several states, broadcast by African-American, Latino, and civil rights groups.
Yeah, and this goes actually to the point you were making a minute ago, how the constituent groups now are starting to mobilize. The ads are somewhat generic. In other words, they don't say, please support sections A, B, C, and D. But what they're hoping to do is just get people more interested, get people mobilized, get them calling Congress and saying, we're watching, we're listening. Part of the problem with this whole healthcare debate is it's complicated. People want pieces of it, but nobody quite knows the whole thing or what they want. But if members of Congress know constituents care and they're watching closely, they're going to react, and that I think, is the purpose of these ads.
And at the moment, with five different versions of it on the Senate and House floors, there can't be really an A, B, C, and D, with one exception, and that has to do with what's emphasized in these ads. That's the public option. That's one thing that people can concentrate on.
Yeah, but even that, in the time we have left, four of the committees approved a public option. One did not, Senate Finance, which tells you there's going to be a floor fight, and the guessing is the House will pass this government-run program, which would compete, of course, with the private insurers. The Senate, it's up in the air. You need 60 votes to overcome procedural hurdles in the Senate, and three Democrats, voted against one form of the public option in committee last week. Five Democrats voted against another. That tells you this thing has problems.
Is that the sort of thing, the one provision that could stop health care reform altogether?
Well, I don't think so. Even though it's the one that we all tend to write about and talk about, there's so much more in there, and there is agreement on certain elements, such as barring insurers from denying people coverage because of pre-existing conditions. There's general agreement that nearly everybody should be required to buy coverage, that sort of thing. So there are certain principles there where there's universal acceptance.
So there's portability also, the idea that you can move from one job to another and still have health care. That and the mandate, you think, for all people to buy it are pretty much universal at this point.
I think so. I think the two big sticking points, and I'm being very general here, number one, affordability. That's a huge concern among Democrats, Republicans, and everybody else. It's fine to set up a system, but if it's going to burden people, then is that the kind of system you want? And that's a real challenge. That's your first problem. Number two, how do you pay for this? The president said he wants it deficit neutral. Well, can it truly be deficit neutral, or is this going to become one more government program about to spiral out of fiscal control?
And here come the governors now. They're worried about increased costs in Medicaid.
Oh, sure. Absolutely, because it ultimately falls back to them. Nobody really has those answers. It's interesting to go read the Congressional Budget Office reports and some of the other independent studies, and try as hard as they might, there are often these sentences in these reports saying, in effect, this is our best estimate, but no one knows.
Okay, I guess there's been some indication that the president would certainly like to see this bill before the end of the year. Other questions as to whether it will simply wipe everything else off the table while it is being debated. A lot now that we don't know. David Lightman, thanks for helping us out with what we do.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
National correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. In a moment, a new justice and a new term for a U.S. Supreme Court in transition on To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. The U.S. Supreme Court began its first full term today with Justice Sonia Sotomayor in place of retired Justice David Souter. Jess Braven covers the court for The Wall Street Journal, and Jess, always good to have you on our program.
Same here.
See anything new and different today?
Well, absolutely. The court reshuffled its nicely upholstered chairs, and we had Justice Breyer, who used to be on the right side, now on the left, next to the new Justice Sonia Sotomayor. They sit in order of seniority.
In order of seniority. So that doesn't mean anything in terms
No.
of left and right, as we think of it, or one
No.
side of the House as opposed to the other.
No.
What about the debate today? There were some arguments.
There were arguments, but they were not the ones that many of us have been looking forward to for the term. They're obviously important to the individuals involved, and one of them has some interest in the court's never-ending fine-tuning of criminal procedure rules. This has to do with the Miranda warning and an instance where a police give a warning and 2.5 years later come back to the same suspect and want to question him again, give him another warning. Did his invocation of the right to counsel the first time, nearly 3 years earlier, prevent the police from asking him questions? So this sort of issue, these sort of fine points of criminal procedure, are actually a big part of the court's docket. We don't always focus on them, though.
Sounds a bit technical. Is this one where the decision could go one way or the other, would make a huge difference in criminal proceedings?
Not really. Because... No, it doesn't. It will mean a lot to this particular defendant. I don't think it will be one of the major criminal procedure cases that we'll have.
What about Justice Sotomayor? Was she an active presence?
She was absolutely an active presence. She had questions up and down the line of both sides in this case and the other case they also heard, which was another fairly technical procedure matter, but she was quite invested in the arguments. She probably spoke more in one day than Justice Thomas has since he joined the court in 1991.
He notoriously silent. Did he have anything to say today?
No, he didn't, and that's his practice, and he's often asked about it. He speaks a lot off the bench, but when he's on the bench, his custom is not to ask any questions.
What about judicial courtesy? Was there any indication that Justice Sotomayor has anything to learn about that?
Oh, no, I'm certainly not anyone to teach any of the justices anything about judicial courtesy. She went in there and was an aggressive questioner, but that is what most of the justices are. It's not a very genteel atmosphere. People who haven't been to the court might be surprised when they come in and see how aggressive a lot of these questions are, how sarcastic they are. They mix it up, and I think that's what they enjoy doing and what the lawyers expect.
I thought there was an interruption. That's the only reason I asked that question of Sotomayor of the Chief Justice, but I gather if there was, it didn't mean much.
I didn't capture sure. anything major. They sometimes do speak over each other.
What are the major cases or the ones that at least at this point we think might be major?
Well, the biggest one that is on the docket in terms of, I think, the at least the symbolic impact is the case involving gun control. The court last week agreed to decide whether the Second Amendment limits state or local governments from any kind of gun regulations. And that's a follow-up to a decision they had last year, which struck down a handgun ban in the District of Columbia. But because Washington, D.C. is not in a state, it has a peculiar legal status. The question is whether the same principles apply to states which have more autonomy than does the District of Columbia. So that's a big one. Then we've got this week two of the most closely watched cases. Tomorrow there's a big free speech case. Can the government criminalize depiction of animal cruelty? This is a fellow who was making or selling videos of dog fights. He was charged and convicted under a statute that made that a crime, likening it to child pornography. Third Circuit Court in Philadelphia struck that down as a free speech violation. The government has appealed, and the court will consider that tomorrow. And then there's a California case on Wednesday dealing with the now famous cross in the Mojave Desert, a cross that in one form or another has been there since the 30s, challenged as violating the Constitution's ban on a government establishment of religion. There are some technical issues involved in this case, but it may be significant for the future of church, state, at least religious symbols on government property.
The cross is on a state or a government-owned tract of land.
That's right. It's in the middle of a very remote part of the Mojave National Preserve, a 1.6 million acre national park near the, I think, the Nevada border.
So three big ones just this week. Does it appear that these are fodder for the so-called conservative majority that they might start trying to push?
Well, you know, the justices have their own idiosyncratic views, and they don't always break down along stereotypical lines. But I think that for those of us who watch the court, and I think for the legal community, and there is a question about the cohesion of the conservatives on the court. The court is narrowly split. There are four, assuming that Justice Sotomayor remains true to form. There are four fairly consistent liberals on the court who tend to see things the same way on the major divisive constitutional issues and issues of statutory interpretation. The five conservatives on the court, however, do not have the same kind of unity in the way they approach legal issues. So in the past few terms, we've seen cases where the conservative, what's generally considered the conservative result, prevails, but you have three different routes there. You have one taken by Justices Scalia and Thomas, which tends to be stake out a fairly aggressive, they would say, principled reading of the Constitution to say flatly overrule precedents they think were wrongly decided. You'll see a narrower approach, sometimes taken by the Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Alito, where they don't overtly overrule a precedent they disagree with, but they narrow it or they distinguish it or they find a way to get to a result without expressly repudiating what the court had done before. And then there's Justice Kennedy, who is sort of a maverick, not to bring up a now shop-worn term, but someone who often finds his own jurisprudence prudence to get to the result he thinks is correct. And so we're wondering if the conservatives are able to unite around a particular approach to their legal philosophy.
Any indication at this point as to whether the conservatives have any sort of agenda or not?
Well, agenda is not really the word that I think that the justices would use. I mean, they are, you know, to be fair to all of them, they're all quite well-read, and they have their well-formed views of the law, but there are tensions in the way that one goes about being a judge, and there's a tension between doing, you know, getting to the answer you think is right and paying proper respect to prior precedent, because one thing the justice system says it favors is stability. So keeping things the way they are, because this, you know, the country expects the law to be a certain way, that lawyers depend on it, lower court judges depend on it, lawmakers depend on it. They all know what they know what certain answers are. The court doesn't want to just change them every time the majority changes, because that makes things unstable. So, but as far as their agenda goes, I think we do have a good signal of at least some new unity on the conservative side, which was an argument they heard last month, a case called Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. The court decided to take a fairly technical case involving the McCain-Feingold Campaign Finance Act and ask the parties to re-argue a much broader issue, the issue being whether limits on corporate political spending are constitutional. To have the court order a re-argument on its own initiative for such a broad question suggests that the conservatives are quite open to the idea of a overruling existing precedents that have upheld some limits on corporate political spending.
So that could be important in a court that is said by people to be in transition, with a very new member in the presence of Sotomayor, and relatively new members with Roberts and Alito, and Roberts, of course, as Chief Justice.
Oh, yes, that's right. And again, we have as well the most senior member of the court, Justice John Paul Stevens, appointed in 1975. He'll turn 90 next spring. He's quite engaged and quite active in the court, but there has been a very significant hint that he may choose to retire, which is that he only has hired one clerk for the following year. He's entitled to four as an active justice. Retired justices get one. So that's been seen as a hint that perhaps he may retire, which would provide another appointment for President Obama and further mix up the dynamics on the court.
Stevens, of course, one of the ironies of history, the most liberal member now appointed by a Republican, Gerald Ford.
That's right. And before that, he was appointed by President Nixon to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. So Justice Stevens was a Republican lawyer in Chicago for his whole career, really, prior to joining the bench, I think, in 1969 or 70. Yes, that's right. And he will say that as people tend to when they're in this position, the world changed around them. They're in the same place they were.
Well, Jess Braven, always good to talk with you.
Same here, Warren.
Supreme Court reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Ed Whalen is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's a former clerk to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, just identified as one of the conservatives on the bench. And Ed Whalen, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
What are you hoping for this term?
Well, I'm hoping that the Supreme Court will move its case law closer to the Constitution. Right now we have a court that I think is fairly described as divided 4-1-4. I have to resist the notion that Justice Kennedy, who provided the fifth vote, in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, upholding Roe v. Wade, the fifth vote for gay rights, fifth vote striking down the death penalty in case after case, fifth vote on the Establishment Clause, liberal interpretations of that, and the national security area can be described as any type of conservative. It's a court where Justice Kennedy remains the deciding vote. I'm hopeful that the court will be ready when cases are properly presented to revisit wrong precedent. We need to have in mind, back to first principles, that we're in a system of separated powers. It's the job of the Supreme Court to get the law right, to protect our rights when the law demands it and just get out of the way when it doesn't. And if the court has wrong precedent that has it in the wrong place on those things, the sooner it's able to correct that, the better.
What opportunities do you see that the court has now to overturn what you regard as wrong precedent?
Well, I don't really see any major opportunities this term. And you know, my focus is really on a broader trajectory. And I think what we see, as Jess Braven mentioned, is the possibility, likelihood even, that President Obama will be able to replace Justice Stevens this year, the possibility he'll be able to replace another justice over the next couple of years. So the court, you know, is very much up for grabs, and I'm really looking more at a 10 or 20-year time frame at this point.
One of the other justices, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has had pancreatic cancer. She's 76 years old, says that she continues to, I think she's 73 years old, that she will continue to serve into her 80s, but she does have a health problem.
You had it right. She's 76.
Oh, excuse me. Okay.
You know, it's obviously difficult to tell what her health situation is, and we obviously wish her the best on her health. But, you know, it's not at all unlikely that she might decide over the next couple of years to retire.
Ed Whalen, again, formerly a clerk for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, now president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Doug Kendall is founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. For the purposes of this program, we'll say you're a bit to the left of Ed Whalen. Thank you a lot for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What do you see as the major opportunities for the court? What do you predict at this point?
Well, I think that most people are focused on the addition of Justice Sotomayor to the court and how she will change the dynamics. And obviously, every new justice changes the dynamics of the court somewhat. It's a very small body. There's only 9 members. And so having a new member, a Latino woman in the on the bench, will certainly change the dynamics a little bit. But I think what we're going to see more this term is really how much the court changed in the 2005 and 2006 years with the appointments of Chief Justice Roberts and more importantly, Justice Alito replacing Justice O'Connor. And that really did shift the center of gravity fairly considerably to the right, at least on some issues. And what we're going to see this term is, I think, some big opportunities for the court's conservatives to move the court to the right on cases in which Justice Kennedy is more conservative than Justice O'Connor was. And so a big example of that is the holdover case, the Citizens United case, where the court is considering overturning, as presumably Ed would like, a 20-year-old precedent that treats corporations differently from individuals in terms of electioneering communications.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to have to take a break. We'll come right back. We'll let you continue with what you think are the opportunities for the conservatives. We'll see if Ed Whalen agrees. We'll also talk with Barry Friedman of NYU on To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point to talk about the latest term of the U.S. Supreme Court. A lot of issues to be decided having to do with guns, animal cruelty, the religious situation, separation of church and state with the Mojave Desert Cross. Talking now about the Citizens United case, which has to do with the free speech rights of corporations, I believe, if I'm correct on that. Doug Kendall, founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, thinks there's an opportunity here for conservatives to move out. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, it's just a pure opportunity to test Chief Justice Roberts' willingness to uphold longstanding precedent. I think it's also, as Ed mentioned, a test of the court's conservatives' willingness to follow first principles. The Constitution talks about protecting we the people and uses the term persons and citizens. It never uses the term corporation, and from the dawn of the Republic, we've treated corporations differently for constitutional purposes. So I think a ruling that overturns these precedents would also violate constitutional first principles and unleash potentially unlimited corporate profits towards influencing elections, which I think would be a disaster in this country.
So this has to do with McCain-Feingold.
Well, it has to do with whether we treat corporations identically to individuals in terms of their ability to influence elections. And if the court overturns these two rulings, it will be both limiting McCain-Feingold, but also wiping out a restriction that goes back to 1907 that limits corporations from using general revenues to influence elections.
So you think this would be a major change then in the way political discourse is conducted in this country?
It would be a major change to the way elections work in this country and also a major change to the law.
Okay. Ed Whalen, back to you again, formerly a clerk to Justice Scalia. What do you say to that?
Well, a few points. First, Doug's argument at heart is a radical argument that corporations don't have First Amendment rights. I would think the New York Times, which after all is run by a corporation, couldn't be barred from speaking. Look, what we have here are corporate rights that are derivative of individual rights. That's the way it's been for a long time. Individuals get together and associate in all sorts of ways. And it's striking, I think, in this case, what we're talking about is a 1990 precedent. That's the oldest here. But even the Solicitor General in the Obama administration has abandoned the rationale that was offered in that 1990 case. I think recognizing that it's incoherent and unsustainable. So I think what you have here is the likelihood that the prospect, at least, that at least five justices will recognize that the court's gone off on a wrong turn. And if that's the case, this may well be a good time to fix it.
And it's gone off on a wrong turn by upholding laws that limit the rights of corporations vis-a-vis campaigns. Is that correct?
That's right, to engage in core political speech.
Okay. Very complicated case. We could spend the rest of the program debating it. An option or an opportunity there, I think, according to both our speakers, for the court to make a significant move. Barry Friedman is vice dean of the law school at NYU. He's author of the book The Will of the People, How Public Opinion Has Influenced the Supreme Court and Shaped the Meaning of the Constitution. Dean Friedman, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Warren.
What do you think are the chances that the court now would go Ed Whalen's way on this issue rather than Doug Kendall's, make a big change in the way that campaigns are conducted?
Well, I think there's a chance that they're going to go Ed Whalen's way, though I think it's important to put that into context. It's interesting. Ed earlier on the show said that there are no major opportunities this term that he was looking at on the conservative side, and I think we've seen a relatively quiet conservative majority on the court. But in this case, the campaign finance case, I think they've got some opportunity, some open space, because if you think about this campaign finance case, the left is split. Some of the people agree with Doug Kendall, and some of the people agree with Ed, frankly, on at least aspects of it on the left.
There are people on the left who think that corporations should have the same free speech rights as individuals?
There are people on the left who are concerned that this is a free speech case and that by regulating the rights of for-profit corporations, you are going to be treading on the rights of other groups that would want to speak, yes.
So, in other words, there's a conflict on the left, and how might that change the court?
Well, so there's two theories of what's going on with the court, or I suppose three. I think it's generally accepted by everybody that the Roberts Court has five pretty conservative votes and could do a lot of conservative things, and at some level it's been quieter than it might have been. So one theory is that Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito are judicial minimalists. They don't like to move too quickly. I don't put much stock in that because I think they have moved quickly in some areas that are below the radar screen. Another theory, which we heard here in part from Jess, is that, and in part from Ed, is that Justice Kennedy might be in a shaky vote for the right, and therefore they can't always muster five votes. But the theory I think I like the best is one that says, look, this is a court that when it looks across the street sees a wildly Democratic Congress and a Democratic president down the street, and it's going to tread carefully unless it's sure it's on safe ground. If that's true, they're going to do better in a case where the left is split than in a case where the left isn't.
So you're suggesting then that the court is worried that if it makes a decision favorable to the right, the Congress and the president then might change the law?
So there's two different sets of worries there, Warren, and it's a good question. When they're interpreting a congressional statute, they've got a certain amount of freedom, but then the worry is precisely as you say, which is that the court could say the statute reads one way, but then Congress and the president could change it to read the other way, and in fact even more to the left the other way. In a constitutional case, of course, it's more difficult for Congress and the president to change the law. But even here, history shows that when the court gets too out of line with what the political branches or the public want, they get in hot water. And I think this is a court that's shown some caution about getting in hot water.
Dean Barry Friedman at the law school at NYU. Back to Ed Whalen with the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Once again, a former clerk to Justice Scalia. Do you think that Justices Alito and Chief Justice Roberts have been sort of looking over their shoulder a little too much?
Well, I don't think so. Though I think Barry presents, three major theories of the court's action, as he indicated, and as I indicated, I think the issue here really is that the difficulty of getting Justice Kennedy on board in a lot of decisions. And the campaign finance is one area where Justice Kennedy has been very strong on the First Amendment generally is an area where he's been very strong. So this is an easier opportunity to coalesce five justices.
So they might then go your way, as we've put it for the purposes of this program.
Yeah, I actually haven't expressed a view on the substantive question,
okay.
I think those who observed the oral argument think there's a good chance that will happen.
So, Doug Kendall, back to you. You brought this up in the first place. What other areas do you think, again, founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, what other opportunities do you think we ought to talk about before we run out of time here?
Well, there's a very interesting case about the constitutionality of a board established by the Sarbanes-Oxley law, which regulates the audits of public companies. And that case challenges the way this board was set up. And it gives Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito their first real attempt or first real opportunity to define their views of executive power. The Congress, in the Bush administration, it was a Republican Congress, put pretty novel restrictions on the president's ability to oversee this board. And it's been challenged by the Free Enterprise Fund, a conservative litigant, that is arguing that it's unconstitutional. And that's this case will give Roberts and Alito, as well as Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, an opportunity to try to push the envelope on what is known as the unitary executive theory, which says that the president gets to control every aspect of every agency that was within the executive's power. And so it's a case that you should be watching, not necessarily because of the result. I suspect that there will be five votes, and there may even be more votes, on the court to strike down this particular setup. But what this court does is allow the court's conservatives an opportunity to try to flesh out their views on executive power in a way that I think could have implications down the road. Now, I think that's, again, probably an area where Justice Kennedy will be a break on how far the court can go, but I think it's a case that's certainly worth watching.
Now, the unitary executive theory was very important during the Bush administration. Vice President Cheney used it a good deal, did he not, especially with regard to the treatment of prisoners in the war on terror, the war itself?
Yeah, that was kind of a variation of it in the foreign policy context and the ability of the president to control all aspects of the country's foreign policy. This is the original formulation of it that was developed in the Reagan administration, I think, while Ed was over there, and so he can speak about this more directly. But it's about really the control of independent agencies and about agencies where the president cannot both appoint and remove the individuals within the executive branch. And the argument, at least the broadest form of it, is that all of the independent agencies, so agencies that have been set up and part of our government since the New Deal, are unconstitutional constitutionally functioning as a headless fourth branch and therefore should be struck down.
Ed Whalen, back to you. You're familiar with all of this. And isn't there an irony here in that the Obama administration, which is arguing for the laws that it exists, is arguing to limit its own powers, whereas conservatives in this case might be arguing to give the Obama administration more power?
Well, there obviously may be issues of executive power where the Obama administration isn't going to be as ardent as the Republican administration should be. Though I just want to reiterate Doug's point, that is the unitary executive theory at issue in this case is something very, very different from what's been given that label over the last several years in the war on terror. And this case, at best, could represent some minor clarification at the edges of separations of powers issues. And I think it's instructive that when we talk about a court in transition and there's suggestion that something momentous is going on, that the all we've talked about so far really in any detail is a campaign finance case, and this obscure but important case involving this very obscure body known as a PCAOB.
Well, maybe PCAOB will become a household word before we're done. But Dean Friedman, let me go back to you at NYU. These obviously are all cases that involve technical legal matters, as they should when we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court. What do you think are some of the cases facing the court now that might lead to the kinds of decisions that get a lot of public attention and generate a lot of political emotion?
Yeah, I'll just point out that a lot of the speakers have said, as you have said over and over, these are cases with technical issues. It's not always the case. When they've got a death penalty or an abortion case, we all sort of grapple with that much more easily. I think there is something unusual going on this term in that we have less of those high flyers. I think the animal cruelty case is going to get a lot of attention. I mean, the media's always got to have a story, and so something's going to be at the top of the line. And I think the animal cruelty case, I think the spin on this, sometimes it's called peekaboo, the Public Accounting Control Board.
Wait a minute, before we go to that, a little more on the animal cruelty case. What exactly does that involve?
I'm sorry. It's a case that involves the question of whether, I think Jess spoke about it earlier, the case of whether the government can criminalize the preparation of materials that display animal cruelty. In this case, it was some video about pit bull training and fighting, but it has a potentially wide-ranging aspect. It's rare that the Supreme Court holds that some kind of speech is completely outside the First Amendment, so child pornography is an example there, and the government is suggesting that animal cruelty depictions are of the same ilk.
Quickly, Doug Kendall, is that one where people on the left are divided, given that there's a free speech issue there?
I'm not actually sure whether there are briefs on both sides of that issue in that case. I mean, one other case I'd point out that we haven't discussed at all is there is a death. There's a juvenile case involving a 13-year-old that's been sent away for prison for life.
Which state is that?
It's out of Florida. It's based on a rape conviction when Joe Sullivan was 13 years old. He was involved in a rape of an elderly woman and sentenced to life without possibility of parole. He and another individual who was slightly older, was 17 years old, and committed an armed robbery, has also been sentenced to life without parole. And so you're not even of age, you can't drink, you commit a crime, which obviously both these crimes are very serious things, but they're placed in what the advocates are calling death in prison circumstances, and the court has already held that you can't be sentenced to death for a non-homicide conviction, and also held that you can't execute a juvenile who was a juvenile at the time of the crime. And so this is the next case in that line, and certainly going to be a hot-button issue this term.
Ed Whalen, are these cases that would divide conservatives and liberals, or would they not necessarily break down on those lines?
Well, case that Doug just mentioned involving life imprisonment for juveniles is a very interesting one because we have the prospect that five justices, including Justice Kennedy, the liberal justices and Justice Kennedy, well, resort to foreign law to redefine the meaning of a provision of our Constitution. And that's a trend we've seen before. It's going to continue. And I think it's one that most Americans recognize is wrong. That is that American provisions of the American Constitution ought to be construed consistent with American law. We ought not be looking at what's going on elsewhere to change the meaning. And of course, it's not just in the death penalty or Eighth Amendment area. There are threats of doing this in a way that would erode our First Amendment free speech rights, our rights of religious liberty, and conversely, efforts to invent new rights that on matters that ought to be resolved through the democratic process, such as same-sex marriage.
Barry Friedman, do you see that trend of using foreign law to interpret American law?
I'm not sure I would interpret the trend the same way. You know, the Supreme Court, since the time of the first Chief Justices, including John Marshall, has referred to foreign law. It seems particularly objectionable to the right now, and you could see some of the reasons why. The justices have gotten a lot of heat for doing this, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens in this case, whether they continue undeterred or whether they recognize that they ought to try to ground their decisions more in United States law.
What's your own feeling about it, if you have one? Is it appropriate to use foreign law, as has been done for so long?
So I think it depends, and you need some nuance here on why the foreign law is being consulted. I mean, I'm somewhat sympathetic to the idea that this is the United States Constitution, and it was framed in a certain context, and it's not necessarily appropriate to look at how things are done in different countries to interpret the Constitution. However, you can often get guidance from looking at what happens in other countries, and there are some aspects of the Constitution that realize that we are a country that lives within a larger global environment and have to get along and relate to other countries. So I think it's just a question of how that information is used.
So there are, then, a lot of opportunities here, possibilities. But, Barry Friedman, again, my take is that you don't think they're likely to move that way, the justices, Roberts and Alito in particular. They're more likely to be incremental, and that's partly because they're concerned about the what the Congress and the White House might do?
I think that's exactly right. And again, the point that I would underscore is it's not just in the case that they have that we're going to find them being incremental, but as I think you've heard time and again during the show, they haven't taken cases that are likely to be flashpoints either. And because they have discretionary jurisdiction, they can decide whether to get themselves in the spotlight or not on particular issues.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for being on our program. We've obviously learned a lot about the court, what's facing it this term, and we'll find out what actually happens as time goes on. Very difficult to predict the U.S. Supreme Court. Barry Friedman, Vice Dean of the Law School at NYU, The Will of the People, How Public Opinion Has Influenced the Supreme Court and Shaped the Meaning of the Constitution. Doug Kendall, founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, somewhat worried that the conservatives might try to make a move. Ed Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, former clerk to Justice Antonin Scalia, afraid that they might not. And our earlier guest, Jess Braven, Supreme Court reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, all of you, very much for being on our program today. Billions of tax dollars have been paid to pharmaceutical giants. Millions of doses of vaccine are on their way to huge warehouses. Thousands of health workers are waiting. That's according to The Washington Post, which then asks, will Americans line up to be vaccinated for swine flu? More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Norman Only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. H1N1 has produced the most ambitious inoculation campaign in American history, but polls show that the public is decidedly ambivalent. Rob Stein is national science reporter for The Washington Post. And Rob, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks for having me here.
Before we get to the question of the polls and whether people really want these inoculations or these inhalations, depending on which they choose, I take it that today already some vaccine has been given out in Indiana and Tennessee.
That's right. The campaign officially got underway today with vaccines starting to show up around the country, and there were two places for sure that started inoculating healthcare workers. One was the Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, which had seen a big increase in the number of kids coming in with flu-like symptoms. And then some healthcare workers also in Indiana started getting it. And there are probably some other places around the country as well.
But they chose Memphis and the state of Indiana because there have been considerable outbreaks there?
Yeah, that hospital in Memphis in particular, they had to set up a tent in their parking lot to handle the number of patients they were seeing coming in. The number of patients more than doubled, and they were having a hard time keeping up with this, so they set up one of these emergency tents in the parking lot for an emergency triage program.
Well, now, there have been reports that in some places the doctors are being swamped by people who want the vaccine. What about these polls? What do they show in terms of what the public in general is likely to do?
Yeah, that's right. There's no question there are a lot of people out there that are anxious to get the vaccine and have been calling their doctor's offices and their pediatrician's offices because they are very concerned about the H1N1 virus. But there's been a spate of public opinion polls that have come out over the last week or two that have shown that the numbers are not as high as federal and state health officials would like to see. For example, there was a poll out of the Harvard School of Public Health that came out on Friday that showed just 40% of adults were sure that they were going to get the vaccine, and only about half were sure they were going to get it for their kids.
That's a pretty significant difference, given that the government has spent $2 billion and produced 250 million doses of vaccine. They could pretty much vaccinate the whole country.
But that's right. Now, these numbers are better than we usually get in a typical seasonal flu year. But as you said, the federal government has spent at least $2 billion so far to buy at least 250 million doses of vaccine. And that's enough vaccine to inoculate more than half of the country, which is the half that would be in these high-risk, these five high-risk groups that the federal officials have identified.
What are those groups?
They are everyone between the ages of 6 months and 24 years of age, anybody who takes care of a toddler, you know, a baby younger than 6 months of age, all healthcare workers, all pregnant women, and any adults who have any kind of health condition that might put them at risk. And those health conditions could include things like asthma, diabetes, obesity.
Okay, so there's obviously a lot of vaccine available. Is this unprecedented? Have they ever produced so much vaccine so quickly?
No, they've never done anything like this. The only thing that's really come close was back in 1976 when they launched a massive national swine flu vaccination program. And, you know, of course, there have been polio vaccination programs and smallpox vaccination programs, but the federal government has never tried to inoculate so many people in such a short period of time. As I said, they hope to get at least half of the population inoculated, and they've made promises to provide a vaccine for everybody if there's enough demand.
Now, in 1976, the occurrence of the flu was not anywhere like it had been predicted, and Gerald Ford, who ordered the production of the vaccine, was thought to look kind of bad on that. What's the reason, do you think, for people now, when there was so much of a panic initially and when the term pandemic was used, everybody got very frightened? Why do you think now there seems to have been a pulling back from that?
Well, you know, it turns out that the H1 virus doesn't seem to cause as severe an illness as had originally been feared when the first reports, you probably remember, emerged in Mexico, where
sure,
there were some real concerns that that the number of people who were getting seriously ill and were dying seemed really high. Turns out that it basically seems to cause an illness that's just about as severe and no more severe than your typical average flu season. Now, the difference is, though, in this case, is that most people don't have any immunity to this virus, and that means that a lot more people are probably going to get infected, and a lot more people are probably going to get sick, end up in the hospital, and more people could end up dying than do die in a typical flu season, which, you know, usually accounts for or is associated with about 36,000 deaths.
36,000. So what are they predicting this time around if $36,000 is what the 1,000 deaths is what the typical flu would cost?
You know, they're really not making predictions at this point because, you know, they're hoping enough people get vaccinated and enough people take the appropriate measures of washing their hands and staying home if they're sick to really keep it from getting as bad as it could. I mean, there was one sort of worst-case scenario that was included in the Presidential Advisory Council that suggested as many as 90,000 deaths could occur, but that's really considered sort of the worst-case scenario, and most experts don't think it really will get that bad.
Are there also anti-government conspiracy theories around and about?
Yeah, you know, this vaccination campaign has produced a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of really bad information about whether the vaccine is safe. There's a lot of misinformation. A lot of people are, you know, saying that they're worried that this is going to become a mandatory vaccination campaign, and that's not the case. This is a voluntary vaccination campaign for most people. It's up to you whether you want to get vaccinated. The federal government is just trying to make it available for everybody that wants it.
You said there's no immunity to this flu, and yet it's not recommended necessarily for adults. My understanding is that there's one theory that perhaps those over a certain age were in fact exposed and did become immune at some time in the past.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about this pandemic is that, you know, normally the people who are most susceptible, most vulnerable to the flu virus are the elderly. They're the ones that ended up getting sickest. They're the ones that are most likely to die. This time around, the elderly seem to not be getting it as nearly as commonly as usual. And in fact, it's younger people and children that seem to be most susceptible. And the feeling is, as you said, that older people, there might have been similar viruses like this circulating and they might have been exposed to it and have built up a certain level of immunity.
Okay, the vaccine is out and about in Tennessee and Indiana for sure. H1N1, swine flu being the target. We'll see what happens next. Rob Stein, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Well, thank you.
National Science Reporter for The Washington Post. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Christian Bordahl and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. Managing producer Cameron Radziner. You can email us or you can share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.